report reads more like a tabloid than a state man's dossier. The scandals keep mounting. Trump University ordered to pay $25 million in restitution. His charity foundation dissolved. Meanwhile, the New York Attorney General has long pursued him for inflating property values. Trump's popularity has taken a further hit due to backlash against his core policies, ranging from harsh anti-immigration measures to reckless foreign interventions. Notably, his unprovoked operation against Iran in West Asia has drawn sharp criticism, deepening concerns about his approach to international stability and undermining support even among some of his traditional backers. Ayatollah Khamenei remains a figure of continuity in Iran. His decisions are anchored in Islamic jurisprudence. He consults with councils of scholars before making policy. His leadership is defined by doctrine, not headlines. He's widely regarded as a moral voice in an immoral world. His defense of Palestine, his critique of Western colonialism, these are not sound bites. They're part of a worldview rooted in history, struggle, and resistance. For over three decades, he has shaped the course of Iran and cast a long shadow across West Asia and beyond. His influence extends beyond borders, beyond ideology. So when Donald Trump mocks Ayatollah Khamenei, it's more than political banter. It's a collision of two worldviews, one grounded in tradition, scholarship, and sacrifice, the other in celebrity, spectacle, and scandal.
Turn off the lights! Turn them off!
A former casino magnate with multiple indictments, a polarized nation, and an uncertain political legacy, Trump can mock from afar. But history has a long memory, and as the old saying goes, he who laughs last, laughs best.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Film fiqh az ulum sharifiye islami.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
داریم از زبان ابا عبدالله به معرفی امام زمان میپردازیم و
امام الحسین علیه السلام introduces امام المهدی and the period of his occultation and also the responsibilities of the people of that time in this way. He states, those Shias who remain steadfast during the major occultation will bear lots of burdens and will be afflicted with lots of difficulties. Now you can see that the divine knowledge of Imam al-Hussein predicted the future correctly. Right now, there are many Shias all across the world who suffer hardships. They will be mocked and they will be told, so where is your hidden Imam?
چقدر شبکه‌های ماهواره‌ای، شبکه‌های مجازی، فضاهای مجازی علیه امام زمان دارن تبلیغ میکنن.
Look how many TV channels and social media are active against Imam al-Mahdi. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam resembles the people who are steadfast in the path of Imam al-Mahdi as are those who fought with their swords in favor of Prophet Muhammad in the battles, and they will be rewarded the same as them. This sentence of Imam al-Hussein shows the great status of the true awaiters of Imam al-Mahdi who tolerate all difficulties and never lose their hope in the reappearance of Imam al-Mahdi. This is the real meaning of steadfastness. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please visit our website at iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the Hall of Shame.
they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice. Our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. But thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too
Hello and welcome back to the program. As we continue to monitor developments in West Asia from the fallout from the U.S.-Israeli aggression against Iran and the ongoing Israeli genocidal war on Palestinians. As always, I'll be discussing those developments with two guests. But first, let's have a quick look at some of the latest developments. Starting in Iran, the country's president, Masoud Pezeshkian, says Israel tried to assassinate him during the 12-day aggression against his country last month. He also says Iran is open to resuming nuclear talks with the Washington's officials, but demands guarantees that Israel won't launch further attacks. Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu says the Zionist regime and the U.S. are coordinating to relocate displaced Gazans abroad as part of Trump's controversial Gaza takeover and own plan. And they're not doing it alone. Britain's Tony Blair Institute has been linked to the project. TBI staff have been involved in discussions on a plan widely condemned for promoting ethnic cleansing, that according to the Financial Times. And France's President Emmanuel Macron's state visit to the UK, what is that about? And as the 17th BRICS summit wraps in Brazil, the country's president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, condemns the Gaza genocide and, of course, the attacks on Iran. Well, joining me to discuss all of that and more in the studio, journalist Sakina Datu, and on Zoom, we have Tariq Uthman, who is a political analyst. Thank you both for being here. All right, President Donald Trump of the United States has welcomed the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to the White House, where the two officials have been discussing many things. Israeli Prime Minister, of course, there on a visit. This comes on the back of the recent attacks on Iran by Israel and the United States and the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Of course, that visit comes as the U.S. continues to mediate indirect negotiations between Iran, between Israel and Hamas, aimed at securing a Gaza ceasefire and, of course, a hostage release agreement. Or captive release agreement. It's the third meeting between Trump and Netanyahu since Trump's return to the presidency and comes just weeks after Trump ordered coordinated strikes on Iranian nuclear sites in support, of course, for Israel's military aggression against Iran. Well, speaking during the dinner with Israeli officials at the White House, the U.S. president made it clear that he wants to bring Iran back, in his word, to the negotiating table, but on his terms. He said he'd love to lift the sanctions, but only if Iran changes course. And Trump hailed the U.S. airstrikes that hit Iranian nuclear sites, calling them non-nuclear, but the biggest bombs we have ever dropped, quote unquote. Sakina, just to start us off, what do you make of these comments? You have the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, and I'm translating, saying Israel has destroyed diplomacy, but that the United States can revive it. Taking into account what Trump has been saying, what the Iranian officials have been saying, what do you make of it all?
I don't know if there is a reason why, you know, Pezeshkian is talking this language, unless there is something that we don't know or we don't see clearly, that there is a strategy that there is coming out of Iran. It is very surprising to hear him talk this language. I mean, you know, they have made it very clear, the U.S., the very fact that, you know, Netanyahu is sitting with Trump after they have committed this, you know, illegal attack on Iran, yeah. And talking about, you know, we want to stop people saying, you know, death to America. And what does this all mean? If you equate it, if you think about it, everything that they have said, he has openly said, that he's not ruling out another attack on Iran. So given these circumstances, you know, why is Iran talking this language of wanting to, you know, speak to, of course, they've said they have not said they want negotiations, even though Trump says that. Yeah. But even the language, it doesn't seem very correct. Now, of course, you know, like I said, there could be a lot more to it than what, you know, meets the eye. But it is a very surprising thing. And I think I would really caution. I would say, you know, Iran needs to be very careful. And we know that there is this government in place, you know, which is a bit more liberal and wants to have, rather has always thought about normalization with the West. But it has been proven time and again that they are not ready. The West will never accept Iran for what it is unless there is a regime change. You know, they're never going to make peace with Iran. So to be honest, it's been quite a surprise for me personally to listen to that tone from the president.
I mean, two things. First off, what I read to you was from the foreign minister, Araghchi's article that he wrote in the Financial Times, and kind of expressing in so many words the same thing, the fact that Iran is asking itself, how can we even trust a partner in a negotiation that was happening prior to the aggression against Iran, and in the middle of it came the Israeli aggression followed by the American aggression. How can we even trust the Americans? That
maybe,
is all there.
Yeah,
I think the understanding is there.
The understanding is there, but maybe what they're trying to do is portray this image of that Iran is always, you know, ready to listen to others, ready to obey international law. But really, the circumstances we are in now, there is no international law. I think, you know, a more hard-standing approach from Iran is something that not just, I think the whole world is looking for that. They're looking for this revolutionary country that showed defiance. And so, like, it's too quick, in my view, it's too early to start talking of this normalization.
Okay. Let's hear from the American president, and then we'll pick up the conversation from there.
One of the things we have with Iran is, you know, we have very, they call biting, they are very biting sanctions. And I would love to be able to, at the right time, take those sanctions off, give them a chance at rebuilding, because I'd like to see Iran build itself back up in a peaceful manner and not going around saying death to America, death to the USA, death to Israel, as they were doing. You know, they were the bully of the Middle East, and now they're not the bully anymore. But they were saying terrible things, and would like to see them. They have such potential, you know, they have the oil power, and they have great people, smart people, energetic people, amazing. And I know so many Iranians from New York. I have a lot of friends, and they're great people.
So, Tariq, what do you make of the American president's comments? He calls Iranians smart, with a lot of potential, Iran an energy resource-rich country. This is a country that he bombed like a couple of weeks ago and ordered or agreed the Israeli bombing of Iran as well. Your reaction?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to hear him say something on the lines of that Iran is the bully of the Middle East. I think that's incredibly ironic, knowing the history of the U.S., not just in the Middle East, but specifically in Iran, the history of the U.S. in propping up bullies in Iran and elsewhere in the Middle East, and in its lack of control or impulse control, you could say, with any anti-imperial, anti-US force in the Middle East. Related to that, I think it's important to understand that, unfortunately, there's a very, very clear equation, you could say, in the Middle East, which is that Westernization means Israelization. To get closer to the West, to the US, if you wanted stronger ties to this bully and you wanted to side with the bully, you needed to side with his friend, in this case, Israel. It's very, very clear. There is no Israeli-Iran deal, in this case, likely speaking, without the submission of Iran to the US as well, joining the rest of the Arab states, which have all, by and large, kissed the American boot. And unfortunately, kissing the American boot is going to require normalization with Israel, accepting Israel as a state and ignoring its settler colonial nature, and accepting that the death and the oppression of Palestinians needs to continue. Now, I don't see why that should happen or why that will happen, because I know that throughout all of time, there are people throughout the Middle East who have looked the threat of U.S. imperialism in the eye and decided that they will be the ones to stand up. And I know that that will continue to happen regardless of what the U.S. attempts and regardless of what deals or bombs it makes. And so, in short, it's the U.S. that is the bully of the Middle East. It's the U.S. and Israel that is the bully of the Middle East. And this is blatantly obvious to anyone who's ever been to the Middle East or has any ties to the Middle East. And we won't have any freedom or prosperity in the Middle East until we rid ourselves of these bullies.
You mentioned Israelization. Others are also using the term Zionization, and I think they're one and the same. Sakina, in terms of lessons learned, countries either in the region or around the world, looking at the Iranian experience with the Americans, so over the years, let's say in recent years, in 2015, that nuclear deal with the Americans, this is the same president, Donald Trump, who withdrew the United States from that nuclear deal, called it the worst deal of the century, something like that, and levying the most stringent sanctions against Iran in the form of the so-called maximum pressure policy. And now he's talking about peace. The fact that you cannot trust the American government
were the United States when it enters into negotiations. And we saw what happened this time around, which was the green-lighting of the aggression against Iran. What lessons are there to be learned by these other countries who have all kinds of relations with the United States?
So I think there are two types of countries in the Middle East and beyond that also, who will take two different type of lessons from this. There are those who will say, example of Syria, Syria didn't, under Bashar al-Assad, did not want to normalize with Israel, was a challenge to the U.S., which is what is happening with Iran now. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he talks about peace with Iran, I think he's genuine. He just wants Iran to do everything that America says, and then there'll be peace. So, he loves the Iranians.
Yeah.
As long as you believe what he tells you, you normalize
with
Israel.
The bully now,
yeah? Exactly. So then he loves the Iranians. So that's not a problem. So either you take that stance, which is what we are seeing from the Gulf states, that we don't want that. We are scared. We don't want to challenge him because we are not big enough, or it's not fulfilling for us personally. It's not filling our pockets enough to stand on a revolutionary side. So the lesson they are taking is, let's normalize. Let's be, good friends with America, and that's the way forward. And then there are the revolutionaries, Iran, but also other countries. I think, countries like Russia and, but even some of the African countries like South Africa, who have very strong, and a lot of BRIC countries, who have been very defiant. We heard about him talking about increasing tariffs again for countries simply wanting to be part of BRICS.
Yeah, so which he calls an un-American organization.
Absolutely. So these countries, I think, will be thinking the best way to maintain our nations and peace is actually to come up with a nuclear weapons. Mm. This is the only way that we can, have peace, what North Korea has done, what India and Pakistan have done. And they look at Iran as if Iran has made a mistake by not developing the weapons. Otherwise, they would have not attacked Iran.
Mm.
So I think what Trump has done is he's made the whole region and the entire globe so much less safe. So the talk of peace and the talk of giving him Nobel Peace Prizes, it's an absolute joke.
Yeah. Perhaps we can come back to that in a little while. Again, staying with the what looks like upcoming negotiations between the Iranians and the Americans, the American president, Donald Trump, told reporters that Tehran has, quote-unquote, reached out to restart negotiations with U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff, suggesting a meeting could happen within the week. The original round of talks, which began in April, collapsed after Israel launched airstrikes on Iran last month, with U.S. bombers joining in.
We have scheduled Iran talks, and they want to talk. They took a big drubbing, I think, when we hit the three sites, really. I would say the three sites, not just the one. The one was a big one, and it was deep in granite, and it was obliterated, it turned out. The Atomic Energy Commission said it is obliterated. I would just want to take our hats off to those incredible flyers, the people that flew that big machine, and frankly, the mechanics and everybody else. I mean, they had zero. They flew for 37 hours with zero problem mechanically. I mean, when you think in carrying the biggest bombs ever, the biggest bombs that we've ever dropped on anybody, when you think non-nuclear. And we want to keep it non-nuclear, by the way. But they did a phenomenal job. It was an amazing job. And I think that was, I was talking to Bibi about it before, that was the very beginning of the end. It ended very quickly after that. I don't want to say what it reminded me of, but if you go back a long time ago, it reminded people of a certain other event. And is Harry Truman's picture is now in the lobby, in a nice location in the lobby where it should have been. But that stopped a lot of fighting, and this stopped a lot of fighting. When that happened, it was a whole different ballgame.
Can you say what might make you have the desire to do another strike on Iran?
Another what?
Another strike on Iran.
I hope we're not going to have to do that. I can't imagine wanting to do that. I can't imagine them wanting to do it. They want to meet. They want to meet. They want to work something out. If you remember when it was done, I sort of said, what's the purpose of talking? It's been knocked out and knocked out completely. But they've requested a meeting, and I'm going to go to a meeting. And if we can put something down on paper, that will be fine. That'll be good. I think they've gained a lot of respect for us. I think they've gained a lot of respect for Israel also. But they would like to meet, and we're going to have a meeting. Steve, when is that meeting going to be? Do you want to say?
Rather, very quickly. Very quickly. In the next week or so.
I mean, that could have been summarized in a few sentences, I guess. Uthman, again, the Iranian foreign minister is saying that in the run-up to the Israeli aggression against Iran, there had been numerous messaging between the two sides, the Iranians and the Americans. In those negotiations, he has spoken of having been on the threshold of a historic agreement that in return, Iran was supposed to agree to certain restrictions to its nuclear program and the removal of all U.S. sanctions against Iran, which is what the Iranians called these negotiations, sanctions-removing negotiations that were so important to Iran and Iranians. But I want to talk about something else, and that is Trump says he's the U.S. president. He claims no one can manipulate him. But based on his words and his actions in regards to Palestine, in regards to Iran, how much of a Zionist puppet do you think he is?
I think it's easy to read it as him being a Zionist puppet, but I think I would personally push back on that. It's not that the U.S. is a puppet of Israel or that Donald Trump is a puppet of Israel. They are partners in crime, fully aware, fully equally culpable in the genocide that they commit. The history of the U.S. aggression in the region goes much deeper than Israel. The U.S. has consistently intervened and reveled in the blood of Arabs and Middle Easterners, even when Israel necessarily didn't necessarily feel it was necessary. It was U.S. is part of the Israeli policy in the Middle East, just as Israel is part of the U.S. policy in the Middle East, but they aren't separable in that sense. And I disagree with this idea that Donald Trump was manipulated away from his anti-war stance and away from his willingness to start new wars. In reality, I think that he, along with every other American president, is well aware of the actions they're taking. They're well aware of the repercussions. They simply don't care, or more likely are happy with the consequences of their actions, happy with the death and murder that they bring to the Middle East and have brought to the Middle East. And so I think, personally, I think this comes from many people in the U.S. wanting to shift responsibility to Israel, shift responsibility for their own state. The truth is much clearer. It's much more straightforward. The U.S. bears more responsibility, I would say, than Israel in its aggression in the Middle East, not the other way around.
Correct. And, that meeting in Washington really has gone from the ridiculous to the absurd. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu surprised Trump with a formal letter nominating him for the Nobel Peace Prize, and it didn't look staged at all. The letter sent to the Nobel Prize Committee praises Trump's leadership in the Middle East. Netanyahu called Trump a leader of the free world. Trump, caught off guard, said the nomination was, quote unquote, very meaningful, especially coming from Netanyahu, who is wanted by the ICC.
I want to express the appreciation and admiration not only of all Israelis, but of the Jewish people and many, many admirers around the world for your leadership of the free world, your leadership of a just cause, and the pursuit of peace and security, which you are leading in many lands, but now especially in the Middle East. We have great opportunities. The President has an extraordinary team, and I think our teams together make an extraordinary combination to meet challenges and seize opportunities. But the President has already realized great opportunities. He forged the Abraham Accords. He's forging peace as we speak in one country and one region after the other. So I want to present to you, Mr. President, the letter I sent to the Nobel Prize Committee. It's nominating you for the Peace Prize, which is well-deserved, and you should get it.
Thank you very much. This I didn't know. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming from you in particular, this is very meaningful. Thank you very much, Bibi.
Thank you. Thank you for everything you're doing.
Thank you. It's a great honor.
I think President Trump had a brilliant vision. It's called free choice. You know, if people want to stay, they can stay. But if they want to leave, they should be able to leave. It shouldn't be a, you know, a prison. It should be an open place and give people a free choice. We're working with the United States very closely about finding countries that will seek to realize what they always say, that they want to give the Palestinians a better future. And those who, and I think we're getting close to finding several countries, and I think this will give, again, the freedom to choose. Palestine should have it, and I hope that we can secure it close by.
We've had great cooperation from surrounding Israel, surrounding countries, great cooperation from every single one of them. So something good will happen.
We're trying to laugh, Sakina. So a Nobel Prize nomination by a prime minister who is wanted by the International Criminal Court to a man who just violated the sovereignty of Iran and breached international law by bombing those three nuclear sites.
You know, they are just as bad as each other. It's nauseating, to be honest, to be listening to them, you know, as if this is some kind of a game that they're playing, like it's some kind of a joke. I think what they don't realize is, you know, you reach a certain stage of arrogance, and this is, you know, whether nationwide, if you look at history, we see this in many empires that have fallen. You know, they reach a level of arrogance whereby they actually think that they are blinding the entire world with what they're saying and doing. And the reality is actually the opposite. I mean, at the moment, there is no state or, you know, who is hated as much as Israel. No person hated as much as Trump and Netanyahu. And it's no more a secret. People around the world, everywhere, really recognize them for what they are. He's talking about, you know, Gazans having the right to, you know, choose where they want to go. They, after having bombed them, killed these people, you know, denied them food, water for 2 years. I mean, even the fact that they have the audacity to sit and speak words like that. And, you know, it reminds me, you know, when sometimes issues like these, it makes you feel person of faith. It makes you reflect. And I reflect on the holy book, you know, on the Holy Quran. And I remember that the Suratul Fil talks about this army of an elephant, you know, who had come to attack Mecca at that time, and they didn't have any you know, weapons. And he's talking about all these amazing weapons that America has. It was similar in that way, you know. There were elephants which were considered to be the biggest weapon at that time, and how were they destroyed? With small birds throwing tiny little stones on them that killed the entire army. So it will take very little. It will take the pain of these Palestinians, of the people of Gaza, you know, the blood that has been shed. That is what it's going to take. It just really infuriates me to listen to them sitting there, you know, and talking about giving each other awards and, like, talking about, you know, giving safe space to Palestinians after what they have done to them for the past 2 years.
Thank you. Sakina Datu, journalist here in the studio with me, and Tariq Uthman, British-Palestinian political analyst. Thank you both for sharing your thoughts with me here on this program, and thank you. Goodbye for now.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding.
Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Amin Rastani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We were trying to take inspiration from Ashura and Karbala, Imam Hussein, not to make the same mistake of the people of Kufa that pushed them to the point where they stood in the face of the Imam and the Imam explained why they're making this mistake. And what does the Imam say there? He says, مُلِئَتْ بُطُونُهُمْ بِالْحَرَامِ, that their bellies have been filled with haram. And this is what we want to speak about tonight, inshallah. I want to share with you some of the hadiths we have. It says every time a person puts into their body a haram morsel, what happens is that the angels send their la'na and curses and damnations upon this person. Right? You know what that means, right? Sometimes we send a la'nat on somebody because we just don't like them. And we feel good after we send la'nat on them. You know? Someone does something like la'nat on you, man. And then we feel good about ourselves. Okay? But with the angels, it's not like that. It's not like the angels are like, let me feel better, la'nat on this person, because they had a haram, they consumed something haram that didn't belong to them. No, the la'na of the angels is, oh Allah, deprive this person of your mercy. Look at all these other people trying their best, hustling. Look at all the good stuff you put out there, oh Allah. But this person, for whatever reason, that we'll get to later, we'll talk about a little bit. For whatever reason, this person still chooses to go the haram route. Yeah, sometimes the situation is pretty dire, and it calls for me to do something that's not permissible initially, but now I have no choice. Those are specific cases. But in this day and age especially, yeah, there's a lot of halal out there too. So these angels, they're sending their la'na on this person. And then slowly it affects our ibadah as well. It says that the ibadah of a person, the worship of a person who does haram khari, okay, that eats and consumes haram, what happens to them? It's like they are building a building that whose foundation is on sand. So you need a building for your future. You need a building for your akhirah. We need our houses in the akhirah, guys. All right? And we need a lot of houses. But a person who is taking in haram, yes, their ibadah is built on a foundation of sand. Yes, another hadith. A couple more and then we'll go move on. A person who has a haram income, it says, Allah does not accept any good deeds from them. Because any good deed they're doing probably is going back to the haram money that they have, right? If it's sadaqah, Allah doesn't accept. If it's freeing a slave, Allah doesn't accept. If it's hajj, umrah, Allah doesn't accept. Yeah, none of these Allah accepts. But as a matter of fact, Allah records sins for them as they do these good deeds. What? Yeah, because you're giving sadaqah. You took from somebody, you give to somebody else. Sorry, Robin Hood. You're not going to make it. If you are taking from one person, and then you're saying, okay, I'm going to give some of it. Some people actually have this mentality. I was surprised when I heard this. I was like, really? This person really thinks this? Yeah. Someone was arguing with me back home once. It was a taxi driver or something. He was talking about how, yeah, there are thieves out there who they will steal people's money and they'll give a portion of it in the way of God so that it's all halal. I'm like, bro, that's not how it works. This person actually thought one of the jobs out there is being a thief. He was actually justifying. He's like, God has put these people's money and wealth in other people's money, and so they have to go and fetch it. I'm like, man, get me out of this car before I turn kafir. Who is this guy? But he was actually arguing for that. Sadaqah isn't going to be accepted. Why? Because the money doesn't belong to you. Hajj, umrah, you're probably paying for hajj and umrah through the haram money that you have, and so on and so forth. Like, you see, there are some things, brothers and sisters, it's a sin that might be worth it. I hate to say it like that, right? But if I'm going to sin, at least I should sin in a way that it doesn't affect everything else. But this is affecting everything else. So let's be careful about this one. Or another one by our sixth imam. It says something along the same lines. If a person who has gotten money and received money through haram means goes for hajj, when this person says, Labbaik, Allahumma labbaik, and you know, sometimes these problematic ones, they feel really spiritual when they go on these journeys. And they feel more spiritual than people who don't commit haram that much. This person, it says, when he goes and says, Labbaik, Allahumma labbaik, the answer to this person is, La labbaika wa la sa'daik. No, we don't want your labbaik. We don't want your sa'daik. We're not interested in you. We don't like you. And this shows that it is not accepted from them. But if a person goes with their halal, with halal money, yeah, then when they say labbaik, Allahumma labbaik, and sa'daik, and all of that, yes, the answer is labbaik wa sa'daik. So we got to be careful about this. Okay, so we have one more thing that we have to be careful about then, because it affects everything. And finally, if none of that helps, because you all are Shia, or we all are Shia, I don't want to sound like I'm not Shia. We are all Shia. Yeah, this last one should do the trick. It says that Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali salawatullah alayhi said, if a person who through haram means consumes the wealth of or the money of someone else, another believer, the verse of Quran said, La ta'kulu amwalakum baynakum bil batil. When it comes to your wealth amongst yourselves, if you are going to consume each other's wealth through transactions and gaining like and earning from each other, it should not be through batil means. So if someone does that though, Imam Ali, he says, this person is not and never is a lover of me, no matter how much they say they're a lover of me. Okay. So if Allah's upset, if that doesn't work, Imam Ali is upset, guys. This is probably going to work sometimes better for us. All right, having said all of that, a few stories I want to share with you about this. There's a person by the name of Karbalai Kazim, okay? This is a person, illiterate, unschooled, village person back maybe 70, 80 years ago-ish. This person who has no knowledge of anything whatsoever is just a normal person. Probably does, you know, farms and things like that, and all of a sudden gains the knowledge of the Quran. Now, this is a story that, this is a person that, you know, we know who he is. It's not something made up. Like, he was tested by the Ayatollah Burujerdis of his time and the others of his time. He could actually tell you, if you showed him Arabic, which part is Quran, which part of it is just normal Arabic. Because some people think all Arabic is Quran, right? We have a joke in Farsi. They say there was two guys fighting. Like, one was Iranian, the other one was Arab. So the Iranian saying bad words to this one, the other one's like coming back at that person with Arabic bad words that he's saying to him. Yeah? And so the Iranian guy starts laughing. They're like, why are you laughing? He's cursing you out. He says, no, he's reading Quran to me. Some people think all Arabic is Quran. Yeah? Well, this person, no. Although he was illiterate, it's famous that they would put Quran in front of him. He would show you which one is Quran, which part is not Quran. They're like, well, how do you know? He says, because one has nur, duh, and the other one doesn't have nur. What? Yes, wow, okay, how'd you get this? It says, how's the students had circled around him once, and they asked him, how'd you get this? He said, no, I mean, I didn't really do much. I just was careful that I don't put haram in my belly. Now, that doesn't mean that a person like me, you and I, if Allah's not giving us special powers, that we probably have some haram in us. No, Allah gives to certain people whatever he wants. So we don't have to have such expectations now. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Do you know the Quran backwards, in and out, and can you tell the nur from it? No, I can't. Then you probably eat haram food every day. That's not a conclusion we can draw necessarily. But good things happen. Brothers and sisters, parentheses, Forget about these things, by the way. These are not the goal in life. The goal is to secure akhirah. All right? These things, if they happen on the side, they happen, alhamdulillah. If not, who cares?
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareemun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
Welcome back, dear listeners. I'm glad to have you with us here on Iran Radio. Let's take a quick look at what's coming your way in the next hour. First, we bring you a new edition of Round the World with reporters.
Then Radio Productions returns with more engaging content. Then stay with us for the Keys of Life. In this enriching segment, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi presents significance into the Islamic way of living, inspired by Mafatihul Hayat, the profound work of Ayatollah Javadi Amali. Each episode offers practical guidance rooted in spirituality and ethics, helping us live with purpose, compassion, and clarity. Coming up, it's time for Round the World with Reporters. Don't go anywhere.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the World with Reporters.
A 2024 report by the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics indicates that over 60% of West Bank farmers face difficulties in marketing their products due to checkpoints and movement restrictions imposed by the occupying Israeli regime. The real hardship began after October 2023 due to the escalation in the occupation and Israel's control over more areas of the West Bank as part of the regime's expansionist agenda.
Many events occurred after October the 7th of 2023 for farmers, as Palestinians turning to farming doubled, leading to more goods in markets and a weakening of demands. Traders benefited from the scenario, but the biggest loser was farmers, who could sell their goods at low prices despite investing more on their farms.
Khalil Atallah is experiencing a potent blend of fear and exhaustion due to the widespread checkpoints and road closures in the West Bank. He witnesses that deterioration in agricultural products before they reach the central market, forcing farmers to sell their goods at very low. This situation is compounded by a significant drop in daily sales, further jeopardizing their livelihoods.
The roads that used to take 2 hours to reach now take a whole day. The farmer gets high-quality goods from the central market, but the goods arrive in local markets in bad quality, often weathered and spoiled due to checkpoints. This affects both farmers and traders due to the high cost involved and low prices when they sell.
These days, we're suffering from water scarcity, as there were not enough rains last year, only a third of the annual average of rainfall. With the occupation's restrictions on water and preventing us from digging wells, this leaves farmers with no water, and even the rise in fertilizer prices keeps them in difficult situations.
Despite extended blockade from roads to markets, Palestinian farmers in the West Bank remain steadfast. But with the continuation of these restrictive policies, can lead to food insecurity in the occupied territories.
Farmers in the West Bank face many challenges that affect their livelihoods and agricultural production. Israeli imposed movement restrictions, insufficient access to land and water resources, destruction of farming properties, and the impact of Israeli settlements are just some of those challenges. Tliba Asi, occupied West Bank.
In support of the oppressed Palestinian people and their heroic resistance, the naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces have targeted the Eternity Sea ship, which was heading to the port of Om al-Rashrash in occupied Palestine. The attack involved an unmanned boat, as well as six crews and ballistic missiles. The operation resulted in the complete sinking of the ship, and the entire operation was recorded. Following the operation, a group of the Yemeni special forces rescued a number of the ship's crew, provided them with medical care, transported them to a safe location. The targeting of the mentioned vessel came after the vessel itself and its operating company resumed operations with the port of Om al-Rashrash, in clear violation of the ban on operations with the Om al-Rashrash port. It also came after the vessel refused calls and warnings from the Yemeni naval forces. The Yemeni armed forces affirm their continued prevention of Israeli shipping in the Red and Arabian Seas. they reiterate their warning to all companies dealing with the ports of occupied Palestine that their ships and crews will be targeted in any area reached by the armed forces, regardless of the destination of those ships. Out of concern for the safety of ships and their crews, we reiterate our warning to companies and countries against the consequences of dealing with the Zionist